welcome to Inside Leisure World. Today we have a great guest who lives in Seal Beach, and he wrote a story about his dad's experiences in World War II. This gentleman's name is Steve Snyder, and he's got an exciting story to tell you. Okay, so tell me about how you got interested in your dad's history. Well, what led you into that point of researching it and then writing, I think you wrote a book on it?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So tell me about that.
Okay. Well, growing up, I knew the basic story of my dad's war experiences, that he was a B-17 bomber pilot. He was stationed in England. His plane was named after my oldest sister, Susan Ruth, conducted bombing missions over occupied Europe, and he was shot down over Belgium, bailed out, and was aided by some underground members, some farmers there. He was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture by the Germans through the help of the people that hid him from house to house. And then he finally joined the French resistance for a while and then was liberated in September of 44 by Patton's Third Army when they came up through France. So I knew the basics of it, and it wasn't until I retired, though, in 2009, that I had the time to really delve into it to try to learn more. And my parents had kept a lot of material. My dad had all his orders and documents, military documents. Mom had kept all his letters that he'd written to her while he was stationed in England. She also kept letters from other crew members and relatives of crew members. And then there was a couple of gentlemen, Belgian gentlemen, who were just young boys at the time of the war, but they became quite interested in retaining and remembering the history. And they interviewed a number of members of the underground, Belgium underground, and recorded and documented that material. And so that gave me a real foundation. I was able to get their bomb group combat missions and squadron diaries that had a lot of detail about the bombing missions. I went on a quest to try to find relatives of my dad's crew. There's a B-17 has a 10-man crew, and I was able to find relatives from all the crew members except one. So I asked them for pictures or newspaper articles, letters, whatever they could send me. I joined a number of World War II associations, the 306 Bomb Group, of which now I'm the vice president, the 8th Air Force Historical Society, and a number of others, started going to reunions. And I would listen to these veteran stories, which were fascinating, and also relatives of veterans that had passed away. And I thought, gosh, these stories are good, but my dad's story is just really compelling. And so I started thinking about writing a book. And when I first started, started thinking about it, I thought, well, this would be a book about my dad. But then I soon realized that, no, it wasn't just about my dad. It was about his entire 10-man crew. And then shortly after that, I recognized that really it's about all these Belgian patriots that risked their lives to help them as well. So it kind of expanded and expanded. I read a lot of books, World War II books, about the air war. Spent hours on the internet doing research. I just became fascinated by it. It became my passion. And it inspired me to write a book.
What's the name of the book?
It's called Shot Down, the True Story of Pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17 Susan Ruth. It took me about 4.5 years of research.
Wow.
Before the book was published. Actually, writing the book itself took about 10 months, and then it took me 8 months to actually publish the book. I formed a publishing company, Seabreeze Publishing LLC, named after the street that I live on, and decided to publish it myself. I worked with independent professionals to do the editing, the graphic arts design for the book cover, the interior layout. I hired a book consultant, a woman called Judith Bryles, who has a company called The Book Shepherd. She lives in Denver, Colorado. They kind of oversaw the project. And hired a printing company in Michigan to print books, and then a fulfillment company in Indiana to handle distribution. And The book was released August 15th on Amazon.com, and it's done really well. I'm really excited about the reader response, getting lots of reviews on Amazon. I just hit 50, which was a milestone, and 47 of those are five-star reviews. And I just won 3 book awards recently within the past week.
What kind of awards? Like,
One is from the Southern California Book Festival. In fact, my wife and I just attended an awards dinner last Saturday night at the historic Roosevelt Hotel up in Hollywood.
Yes.
The award I received from them was an honorable mention in general nonfiction. And then I won 2 awards recently from the USA Book News Best Books Award. I won a finalist award in History General and another finalist award in Military History.
Very good. Great.
I'm starting to do a lot of presentations and book signings and just trying to get the word out.
Well, you did a presentation at the Leisure World Library.
Correct.
Because I went by there and I saw you had an audience and you were talking about your book.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. I do PowerPoint presentations, but then I also do just talks like I did in here at Leisure World a couple weeks ago.
Okay. Now, you gave us a lot of information, so we're going to go back to the beginning and then go little by little, and then I know we have some photographs that we're going to also display for the audience. So you mentioned the name of the aircraft. It was the Susan Ruth?
Correct.
And you mentioned it was named after your sister?
Correct.
Now, how does someone get to name an aircraft? Does the crew vote on it? Does the captain name it? Or how does it come to be?
Well, my dad was the first pilot. Excuse me. There's 2 pilots on a B-17, the first pilot and the co-pilot. And being the first pilot, he really has the say on what the plane is named. A lot of times he'll talk to his crew members and about it as well. But that was kind of his decision to being the commander of the plane. She was 1 year old when he went overseas.
Because that was in honor of his daughter. That was his first, was it a firstborn daughter? Or?
Yes. My mother's name was Ruth.
Ruth, okay.
And so that was my sister's middle name.
So he got 2 points. He got double points for his wife's name and his daughter's name.
Correct.
Okay. And that would be your sister.
Yes.
Okay, got it. All right.
I didn't come along until after the war.
Oh, okay. All right. So, as the plane is named then, what's the next step mission-wise? How did he get involved in doing these missions? And where was he flying out of when he was doing the missions?
Well, maybe to take a step back, okay. He initially joined the Army. President Roosevelt came out in the fall of 1940 with the first peacetime draft in the U.S. for men between the ages of 21 and 35. when the U.S. actually entered the war, that was expanded from 18 to 45. Mm-hmm. But he joined the Army in April of 1941. Okay. My mother graduated from UCLA a couple months later, and then they got married on July 3rd. He was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington, and she went up to visit him in December, shortly after Pearl Harbor on December 7th, to see him, and 9 months later Susan Ruth was born.
Okay.
So he was married and had a child on the way, so he felt he needed to make more money to be able to support his family, so he decided to volunteer for the Air Force, because the Air Force paid better than the Army. So he entered the pilot training program in June of 1942. He went through pre-flight training in Santa Ana and then went through various stages of pilot training.
Now, when you say you joined the Air Force, at that time the Army had an Air Corps, right? Was it a separate, or was there a separate Air Force at that time?
No, it was called the Army Air Corps at that time, so it wasn't a freestanding entity like it is today.
Okay.
And really, there wasn't much of an Air Force prior to World War II. In fact, the U.S. military at the beginning of the war was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world behind nations such as Czechoslovakia and Belgium. Mm-hmm. they're very ill-equipped. They really had to gear up. So my dad went through various stages of pilot training. He was up in Santa Maria, and was at Lemoore in Central California. That one, he graduated from advanced pilot training in Douglas, Arizona, where he received his pilot's wings, and he's commissioned to a second lieutenant. Then he went through transitional training, learned how to fly a B-17, and then through combat, through crew training down in Texas. And finally, they were assigned overseas. He reported to the 306 Bomb Group based at Thurlow, England, on October 1st, 1943. The 306 was part of the 8th Air Force. There are over 40 bomb groups within the 8th Air Force. The 306 was one of them. Its nickname was First Over Germany, since it was the first bomb group to bomb a target located within Germany.
Okay, now, he trains then on a specific craft?
Yes.
Or is it the B-17 all the time?
Well, through pilot training, they had different phases. In primary pilot training, they train on an old World War I biplane. Okay. And then in basic training, they went to a single-wing plane. And then in advanced training, they went to a twin-engine plane. Okay. And then from there, he transitioned into the four-engine B-17.
Okay. So describe a B-17 to the audience. What kind of aircraft is it? This category, it's machinery, it's the crew. Can you kind of describe that?
Sure, okay. Sure. There were two main bombers in the European theater, with a B-17, nicknamed a Flying Fortress, and a B-24, which is a Liberator. My dad was signed to a B-17. They nicknamed it a Flying Fortress because it could take so much damage and keep flying. It's amazing some of the pictures you'll see of the damage, the battle damage those B-17s took, and still were able to fly and make it back to England from bombing runs. The B-17 had a 10-man crew. They had four officers, the bombardier, the navigator, and then the two pilots, and then there were six enlisted men who were mainly gunners. They had a lot of firepower. The machine guns on the plane were 50 caliber machine guns. And the combat missions, that's, we could talk about that for quite a bit. In my talks, when I do presentations, PowerPoint presentations, I show the crew positions in the plane and what each man did.
Can you briefly tell us, like, how many gunners were there?
Six. There was a top turret gunner who was also the flight engineer. There were a ball turret gunner. It was in the ball turret beneath the plane, which is an unbelievably cramped position. When they get in the ball turret, the ball turret gunner's knees would pretty much be up around his ears.
You have to be a pretty small guy to be in that position?
Yeah, it's a really small area. And the combat missions lasted 8 to 10 hours. So he was in there for that little cramped position for a long period of time. Then you had two waist gunners that were behind the ball turret gunner. And then you had a tail gunner as well, which was also a pretty cramped position. There was also a chin turret of two 50 caliber machine guns at the nose of the plane that the bombardier manned when they weren't in the bombing run.
Okay, so go ahead. Continue with the flight information there.
Well, our dad's crew first started flying missions in November. Their first mission was on November 3rd to Wilhelmshaven, Germany. And flying missions was really, really stressful and intense. As I mentioned, there are about 40 bomb group bases in England. And on these missions, bombers would take up from all these bases, which were only about 5 to 10 miles apart. So here you have hundreds of bombers taking off. There was no traffic control back then. There was no radar on the planes. And oftentimes, typical English weather was overcast, so they really couldn't see anything. There were a lot of mid-air collisions. They really couldn't see until they got above the clouds. And then they had to get into formations. of different squadrons and bomb groups.
They had to find themselves up there.
Exactly. And forming up would take 1 to 2 hours before they even headed over across the English Channel for their bombing mission. So that was a pretty intense situation right there. And when after they finally formed up, then they would head over the English Channel to occupied Europe for their bombing missions. The Germans had radar stations along the continental coast, so they knew when the planes took off and when they were going to arrive. And pretty much as soon as the planes, you know, hit mainland Europe, the German fighters were there to meet them and go through that. At the beginning of the war, the 8th Air Force Command thought that the bombers could defend themselves. They're flying a tight formation with these hundreds of bombers with all these machine guns and gunners, that they could fight off the German fighters, but that wasn't the case. In the early part of the war, in the bombing missions in 1942, in 1943, the 8th Air Force took tremendous losses. And finally, the 8th Bomber Command realized that they needed escorts, fighter escorts. And so they started sending up P-38 Lightnings and P-47 Thunderbolts to help them and escort them. But the problem there was that they didn't have the fuel capacity to follow the bombers all the way to the target. Mm-hmm. They could only make it to about mainland Europe, and then they had to turn around. Well, that didn't help a great deal because the Luftwaffe, as the German Air Force was called, would just wait for the U.S. fighters to turn back, and then they'd swoop down on the B-17s or B-24s. It wasn't until the beginning of 1944, with the not the invention, but the use of P-51 Mustangs that had the fuel capacity to escort the bombers all the way to the target, mm-hmm. that they really had protection. And the P-51s, they were amazing aircraft. They virtually wiped out the German Luftwaffe. By D-Day on June 6th of 1944, the Luftwaffe had virtually been eliminated by that time.
Okay. All right, so he's doing his doing his missions, and something happens, and he's shot down?
Well, once the bombers would near the target, they'd reach a point which was called the IP, or initial point, and that's when the bomb run actually started. Mm-hmm. And at that point, the bombardier actually took over command of the plane. There was a revolutionary device called the Norden Bomb Sight, which was an analog computer, and it could calculate and determine the speed of the plane, the wind speed, crosswind, to try to accurately target where the bombs were going to land. And the Norden bomb sight was tied into the autopilot of the plane. So once they started their initial bomb run, the bombardier took control of the plane from the pilot. And they had to fly a steady line without any deviation, or so the plane would be steady. They could accurately hone in on the target. When they started the bomb run, the German fighters would leave, but then they would run into flak, the German anti-aircraft fire. And these were 88 millimeter guns. They could fire 20 shells a minute, and they were calibrated to explode, the shells to explode at the same altitude that the bombers were flying. So the bombers, when they started the bomb run, they'd be flying straight to the target, and they'd see all these shells exploding ahead of them. There'd be black puffs, and they had to fly right into that. So there's no way they could defend themselves.
So they know they're flak. If they're flying into one of those, they're going to get hit.
Right. They had the plane damaged. If it got a direct hit, the plane would explode and basically just disappear. Or if it hit a wing, it knocked the wing off, and then they'd go down. The aluminum skin on the B-17s was very thin. When the shells would explode, they'd explode into just hundreds of pieces of metal of all shapes and sizes that could easily penetrate the skin of the plane.
So these guys flying these planes knew that they were heading toward certain death if one of those shells exploded near them or hit the plane directly.
Right.
So that took a lot of guts to do that.
It sure did. Plus, they had other factors they had to deal with. Those planes at that time, they weren't pressurized at all. The waste gunner's windows were open, so the air would come in. The planes would leak in the rain. And they would fly at 20 to 30,000 feet. So once you hit 10,000 feet, you have to go on oxygen, or else after 10 minutes, you'll pass out and eventually die. Also, the temperatures at that altitude were 40 to 60 degrees below zero, so they had to wear heavy clothing to protect them from the cold. Many, many frostbite injuries occurred during...
Just for flying that height, yeah.
Yeah, so it was really an experience. As far as my dad's concerned, they were on a bombing mission on November 8th, 1944. It was a mission to Frankfurt, and they dropped their bombs, but their plane had been hit by anti-aircraft fire by flak, and it had damaged the bomb bay doors, and they couldn't pull the doors back up. So when they tried to form back up with the other B-17s, they head back to England. With the bomb bay doors being open, it caused a drag on the plane that reduced its speed, and they couldn't keep up. So they fell behind the formation, and they were singled out by a couple of German fighters, Focke-Wulf 190s. You know, it's a scenario that you'd see in Africa with an injured or ill wildebeest, where the lions would just swoop on the one that was lagging behind and take it down. And in that battle, the two Focke-Wulf shot down my dad's plane. Both those Focke-Wulf planes were shot down as well, though. One of the planes, piloted by Siegfried Merrick, he was killed in the plane, and he crashed with the plane. The other Focke-Wulf was piloted by Lieutenant Hans Berger. He was able to parachute out, and he made it through the war. It's interesting, in my research, you know, my wife Glenda asked me, or told me, why don't you try to find the Luftwaffe pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I thought it was a crazy idea, like, how am I ever going to do that? But I found him.
Where did you find him?
I went to Google and just put in trying to find a Luftwaffe pilot, and various sites came up, and I joined a couple of forums. One was Axis History Forum, and the other was Luftwaffe Research and Records Forum. And in a week, I got responses back. I posted, I knew the day my dad was shot down, where he was shot down, the time he was shot down. And in a week, two responses, one from a guy in Belgium and another from a man in England. And the gentleman in Belgium, he was a Luftwaffe historian and written quite a few books about the Luftwaffe. So he told me on that day, there were 10 B-17s that were shot down, according to the Luftwaffe records. And there was one shot down by Hans Berger south of Chimay, Belgium, in the southern part of Belgium, which had to be my dad's plane. Luckily, Hans was an interpreter and could speak English. So through a series of interviews via the email and also a telephone, he gave me some wonderful information that I included in my book about what it was like for a German pilot to go up against the 8th Air Force. Those guys were just trying to do a job, just like the U.S. pilots. Right. They were all young men, most of them, you know, around 20 years old, trying to stay alive. And so it was a daunting task for a German pilot to go up against the 8th Air Force because of the superior numbers that the U.S. could put up. The U.S. production capability just overwhelmed what Germany could do. Also, the Germans, they had no limit on the number of missions you could fly. The German pilots had to fly until either they were shot down and killed or luckily made it through the war. Initially, the U.S. had no mission limit either, which was really demoralizing because, again, you're thinking, I'm never going to make it. I'm going to be killed or end up a POW. Eventually, the U.S. did put in a 25 mission limit and then was raised to 30 and 35 by the end of the war.
Okay. So was Hans happy to hear from you, and or what was his reaction?
Surprise. A little bit shocked, and it took me a while to build up trust with him, because I wanted to know so much information. I was just asking question after question, and this one time I was getting a little too personal, I guess. And he goes, "Well, you know, I don't really know you. You're asking me some personal questions." We built up a trust, and he gave me a lot of information. At times, though, it would get to him, because it brought back a lot of bad memories.
Sure.
You know, most of the pilots, his fellow pilots in the Luftwaffe, were killed.
Those are his friends.
Yeah.
Okay, and then, so the plane goes down, and your dad parachutes out? Or how
yes,
did he get out of
there were two crew members that died in the plane from the machine gun fire, the cannon fire from the Luftwaffe planes, the Walter gunner Lewis Colward and the radio operator Ross Kaler. The other eight crewmen bailed out. My dad was the last one to bail out, and he bailed out fairly near where the plane crashed down in an area, a little village called Mackenwas, Belgium. It was just right on the French border. And he came down, and his parachute got hung up in some trees, but he was dangling 20 feet off the ground. And fortunately, a couple of Belgian farmers came out, saw him, and got a ladder so we could get down. They told him to stay put, because it was during the day, around 12:30 in the afternoon. And there were lots of German patrols in the area trying to find these guys that parachuted out. So he stayed there until night, when they came back and got him, and they took him to one of the farmers.
These guys are risking their lives also helping your dad, right? Because it's Belgium is under the control of Germany at that time.
Yeah, it was occupied.
Yeah. So if they would have been caught, they would have probably been shot or
yeah, they would have been shot. Their families could have been shot or sent to prison camps, concentration camps.
So
my dad was missing in action for a total of 7 months. My mother didn't know if he was dead or alive. Actually, my parents' second child, my sister Nancy, was born while he was missing in action.
Wow. Okay, so they pick him up, and then what happens after that?
Well, typically what happened with down airmen that would be picked up by the underground, whether it's in France or Belgium or the Netherlands, they would try to get him out through France into Spain, into British-controlled Gibraltar, and then back to England. But with my dad, something always went wrong, and they could never get him out. So he was hidden from house to house to house. How long he stayed at a given place kind of depended on various factors. It was how brave that person or family was and how safe they thought it was going to be. He might stay one night in one house and maybe 6 weeks at another house. He finally got tired of hiding, and he decided to join up with the French resistance, a group called the Mackie. And there he fought German convoys and laid mines and roads and attacked German convoys until finally, on September 2nd of 1944, he was liberated by Patton's Third Army.
Wow.
And then he made it back to England and then came home. He was actually the first member of his crew to make it back to the U.S.
Can you describe, or did he describe, the actual meeting when he is meeting with Patton's army group? How did that come to be? Or you just walk up and talk to them, or how? What happens?
Well, the Mackie, the resistance group he was with, they had set a trap for a convoy that day, but that convoy never showed up. But I don't know how, but he heard that there were American troops in the area, actually a little town called Trelone, France, which is just across the border. And so he hightailed it over there, and he went up to an army officer and just identified himself. He was a downed airman. And so he had to go through an interrogation, though, because at the time, the Germans had a lot of English-speaking guys that would try to infiltrate underground groups and so forth. And so he had to kind of prove he was who he was.
Absolutely.
And then when they accepted that, then he went to Paris, and then from Paris went back to England.
Did he speak in Belgium? Is the official language French, German, or
well, actually,
or no?
Belgium is kind of divided in half. Okay. There's the northern area of Flanders, where they speak Dutch.
Dutch, okay.
And then the southern part of Belgium, called Wallonia, they speak French. So he was in the southern section.
So how did he communicate? Or were they English-speaking, or was he French-speaking, your dad?
I don't know. None of the people could speak English, you know, back then, and my dad couldn't speak French. They had a little booklet that in their escape kit, in case they were shot down, there were a number of different things that were in the escape kit, but one was a little French-English dictionary. And then just gradually he learned conversational French from the people there. You know, there's nothing to do.
Okay.
You know, when you're hiding, they'd play cards and play games, and there were some younger girls there in a couple of the houses that tried to teach him to speak French. So he could converse fairly well by the time he left.
Very good. You mentioned you were able to communicate with Hans, or Hans Berger. Were you able to communicate with anyone in the resistance that assisted your dad?
Well, I didn't personally. There was a gentleman called Paul Delahaye that was 13 years old when the war ended in Belgium. And his family went through a lot. And later on in life, he formed the Belgium American Foundation to remember and honor the Allied troops that liberated their country from Nazi occupation. And he interviewed a lot of the underground members and documented a lot of that information. He also built a number of memorials over there to various army groups, and erected one to my dad's crew in 1989. My dad and the three other living crewmen at the time and their spouses went over for the dedication, which was a very moving experience. And that brought a lot of the war back, because he didn't talk about it too much until he started going back to Belgium. He kept in contact with his Belgian helpers after the war. They would write quite a bit. And the first trip he took back was in 1970.
Oh, great. So he got a chance to re-meet him under better circumstances.
Yes. I only met one of his Belgian helpers. That was in 1994 when we went over for the 50th anniversary of the Belgian liberation, my wife and I, and my sister Nancy and my parents. And she was the only one living at the time. And that was a very emotional experience. The Belgian people really remember and appreciate being liberated from the Nazis. And the older generation do a fabulous job of educating the younger people about what it meant and what it means. And they have celebrations every year over there to commemorate the occasion. I've been over three times with my wife in 94 when I went with my parents again for the 60th anniversary in 2004, and then also for the 70th anniversary just a couple months ago. And it was 5 days of celebrations. They have set up these huge tents where hundreds and hundreds of Belgian people come for these big parties, and they have bands. Usually they play the old big band music, and you dance, and the Chimay beer, this area is right near Chimay, where there's a
good beer?
Trappist brewery. Oh, the best beer. They say the best beer in the neighborhood and the best beer in the world. And they have military parades. All the U.S. military comes down. The U.S. ambassador came down. In fact, we went back to Brussels, and the U.S. ambassador, Denise Bauer, invited us over to a residence at the embassy in Brussels, which was a unique experience.
I noticed you have a jacket here, and you have an emblem on your right side. What's that emblem?
Well, this jacket, they were called A2 jackets during the war, bomber jackets. This isn't actually my dad's original jacket. I don't know what happened to that. He bought this later on in life, but it's an authentic replica of it. The patches on the side, though, are authentic. I got to look at them here. This is the Army Air Corps patch.
With wings, start with wings.
And this is the 8th Air Force patch. It has an 8 there.
Okay.
This is, my dad, as I mentioned, was in the 306 bomb group, and within each bomb group were four bomb squadrons. And this is the squadron patch my dad was in. It's the 369th Fightin' Bightin' Squadron there at Thurlai. And then this is his actual name tag. It says H.J. Snyder on it, Howard John Snyder. So I'm pretty proud to wear that. He wore this before he died, you know, until he died in 2007.
Wow.
Okay.
That's a neat jacket.
And I'm actually wearing my dad's ring that he got at when he graduated from Advanced Flying School in Dalhart, Texas.
Okay. Later on, we'll get some close-ups of all those things there for the program. Okay, and did you think about anything else that on your story? You were talking about all the reunions. You went back. You had some good beer. You met the ambassador.
There was another gentleman too that helped me a great deal with the book. I mentioned Paul Delahaye. He died in 2013. He has two daughters. They're kind of very active in carrying on with this organization. And I was asking her a bunch of questions. One of the daughters, Crystal Delahaye, who's the secretary of the association, and she said, "Well, I don't know those. You really need to talk to Jacques Lalot, who's done a lot of research." And he provided me with a great deal of information. He had also interviewed a number of people involved in the activities and the events of that time, both underground members and a bomber pilot, a member of another crew who was shot down, and some of his men were involved in some incidents. Then he was going to write a book, but he just never really could afford to do it. So he gave me all his information. He had a lot of pictures, too. One thing that makes my book Shot Down unique is there's over 200 time period photographs of the people that took part in the events that are described in the book. And my dad had a lot of these that were sent to him by his Belgium helpers, but then Jacques Lalot had a lot as well. So it was great to meet him and thank him for all his help in putting the book together.
Now, do you have a website?
Yes. It's pretty comprehensive. It's stevesnyderauthor.com. There's a lot of content. I have a blog that I post to there.
Now, the name again of that website is?
stevesnyderauthor.com.
Okay.
And you can buy my book on my website.
Okay.
If you want a signed copy. You can get the book a little bit cheaper on Amazon.
Anything you'd like to see in the wrap-up here?
Oh, it was just a marvelous experience. I had no intention initially to write a book. I just wanted to organize all my dad's material and kind of put it in order. But just one thing led to another, and it's been a very enlightening experience. You know, the whole publishing a book was something I had no familiarity with at all. And going around to these different bomb group reunions, I mentioned the 306 bomb group, their reunion this year was in Colorado Springs. I also went to the 8th Air Force Historical Society reunion in Nashville, Tennessee. So just making a lot of good friends.
Great.
And it's fun, all these presentations I'm doing and book signings, it's exciting. I guess I'll close in saying in my when I wrote the book, I wanted a book that would appeal to real World War II buffs and history buffs, but I also wanted a book that would appeal to the general public, people that had little knowledge or little interest in the war. I just didn't want it to be a war book for men. I wanted it to be a good story that would appeal to women as well. And based on the reader reaction I've gotten so far, it seems like I may have achieved in doing that.
Great.
So I'm real pleased about that.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.